53. I'm Rod Hill, FM.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Live. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network, serving the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and at least attempting to deliver honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. Now, I want you to consider how absolutely crazy this is. The Democrats run the show, for the most part, in both Washington State and Oregon. And in both states, they are going for record big tax increases, one already in place in Washington State, and one near to in place in Oregon, although the legislature should wrap up by Sunday. And if there is any justice in the world, their massive tax increase will not go through. But the one in Olympia already did. And what do the Democrats do? They come out immediately after this record-sized tax increase and say, by the way, folks, we're still going to be short hundreds of millions of dollars over the next few years. So I thought I'd talk to a person. While I've asked for people who are members of the party of slavery, you know, the Democrats, they aren't willing to come on the program. But Senator Chris Gildon is, and he is a Republican who represents Washington's 25th district, which is primarily Puyallup and the surrounding area. Senator, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Hey, Lars. Thanks for having me. I'm doing well. Thanks.
So how is it possible to pass the biggest tax increase in state history and then immediately come out and say, by the way, we're going to be short a gigantic amount of money, $700 million or so?
You know, it's absolutely unbelievable. In total, they raised state-level taxes about $9.3 billion and another just almost $3 billion in local taxes. And still, at the end of the budget cycle, they're going to have a grand total of about $2 million in the bank. Just for perspective, because you start talking about millions and billions, think about a family that earns around $100,000. They get about a 10% raise, and at the end of the month, they're going to have $3.50 in their bank account. That's kind of what we're looking at here.
That's a great way to put it, because did they do any significant cutting at all to all the various things that state government does?
You know, it just was really interesting what they did. And a lot of it, I think, was bad politics. But they raised gas taxes. They tried to raise college tuition. They raised tax on business, tax on property, tax on sales. I mean, basically, if you could see it, touch it, or taste it in Washington State, they probably increased the tax on it this last year. But they just spent so much that they're having trouble making ends meet. And the frustrating thing to me, Lars, is it didn't have to be that way. Senate Republicans, myself and Senator Nikki Torres, proposed the Save Washington budget, which was a comprehensive budget that didn't have any cuts to services, no tax increases. It preserved our rainy day fund, met all of our state's needs in a responsible manner, and I've got to say it was largely ignored, but we let the Democrats know that they had an option, and every Democrat, at least in the state Senate, voted against that Save Washington budget two times this last session.
Well, are they unwilling to cut anything? Because, Senator, I don't know if I've ever asked you this, but every time I have a candidate on, my favorite question to ask them, no matter what level of government they're going for, city council, county commission, state legislature, governor, what mayor, I ask them, is there something your government, the one you're running for, does that it doesn't need to be doing? And most of them, even the Republicans, act like, you know, they look like a deer in the headlights because they say, well, what do you mean? I said, well, let's put it this way. Is everything your government agency does absolutely rock solid, essential, and you cannot part with it? And, well, you know, there's probably some stuff we don't really have to do. I said, I think there's a lot of stuff you don't have to do and that you should get out of those, you know, those activities, whatever they are, especially if they cost a lot of money. And usually they do. So, you know, the Democrats can't see their way clear to say everything we do is absolutely essential and nothing can be cut?
Well, you know, the interesting thing to me was Governor Ferguson's response to this economic revenue forecast, which was just horrible in my view. And he came out and he started blaming the federal government, saying that the feds are the problem with tariffs and all of the uncertainty. Well, guess what? The last time I checked, it wasn't the White House that raised record-breaking taxes in Olympia. It was Governor Ferguson and the legislative Democrats that did that. And I think it's a really bold move to raise taxes on working-class families, miss your revenue targets, and then blame others for your actions when you knowingly did that, because you had the option of the Save Washington budget, which did not include all of those taxes and fee increases. And furthermore, I just say, one of the things that I told my colleagues in the legislature is, if you are truly worried about the impact that tariffs may or may not have on our economy, then you should do things that are in your power to safeguard that, meaning do not raise taxes this year. Leave yourself some options for the future.
Well, and yet he wanted to blame Trump directly, didn't he? And I kind of take that personally. I support President Trump. I call him out when I think he's wrong, and that happens occasionally, but not very often at all. But he's saying Trump's at fault. The country is doing well. I mean, we've got low unemployment. The forecast inflation that was supposed to result from the tariffs isn't there. Oil prices are down. Gas prices should follow. Other things are going well. The GDP numbers are up. And yet Washington and Oregon seem to be two of the states, blue states, and not a coincidence there, who are saying, wow, things are rough here. Yeah, you've got insane levels of taxation and regulation. Trump is cutting them at the national level. The nation is doing well. You're not cutting them at the local level. Your area is not doing well, but the country is. Do you see the pattern? Is Ferguson just too thick to understand that?
I mean, it's just that old adage that you've heard over and over again. You tax the things you want less of. They tax property. They tax business. Guess what? You're going to have fewer housing opportunities, and you're going to have fewer businesses investing in our state. It's really quite simple. I really just find it frustrating whenever politicians do not accept responsibility for their very direct actions.
And look at all the businesses that are leaving, Senator. I mean, there are all these big and small. Now, the big ones we tend to notice. The small ones, it's harder to keep track of all the small businesses that have just fled. But almost anywhere I drive, Tina and I drive around the Northwest a lot, both states, and we see empty storefront after empty storefront. That's not a healthy business climate, just read with that litmus test.
Absolutely right. I mean, I think we're kind of similar to the Titanic right now, but rather than hit the iceberg, we just barely missed this financial iceberg. But I've got to tell you, there's a lot more hazards in front of us, and we need to be very vigilant.
Well, and the other piece of your metaphor, that if I could continue that, the Titanic floated for a while. And I think both Oregon and Washington will float for a while. But while, you know, the folks, the upper income earners and their businesses are leaving the region, and all the money spent on various programs to draw more technology to the region, that doesn't seem to have done much of anything. They're fleeing as well. So the boat is still floating for now, but the sinking may become very, very, very soon. That is Senator Chris Gildon, who is a Republican that represents the 25th District and QL. Senator, thanks very much for the time. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. He's the best investment in talk radio, and it's free. Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and always glad to welcome back to the show Bob Barr, former CIA analyst and member of Congress. Bob, welcome.
Well, thank you. Great to be back with you, Laura. Sorry for my absence for the last couple of weeks.
No worries. We understand. Let me ask you about this. I know we had planned to talk about consent decrees, and I think we can touch on that in a bit. I think it's a very important subject. But I'm more concerned at this point about a couple of things. One, your view as a former member of Congress of the big, beautiful bill, which is a big, bloated spending bill, and apparently it has sparked a fight between Elon Musk and Donald Trump. And I think Musk is actually right. And I even suspect that Trump thinks he's right, but now they're sparring with each other, because I think Trump knows that we spend too much money. And I want to know, as a former member of Congress, why is it that a Republican Congress seems to be genetically incapable of bringing government spending down?
Well, part of the problem is we have a two-party system. We don't have an open political system, Lars. You know, we've talked about this. We have a two-party system. It's closed. And when you have a president of one party, and the House and or Senate controlled by that same party, then the Congress views its job as doing what the president wants and sort of forgetting its own responsibility. Congress has a responsibility under the Constitution that is different from the president's. And even though when I was in the Congress as a Republican, I supported, for the couple of years that President Bush was in, supported President Bush, I wasn't a vote simply because he was of the same party. And members of Congress need to remember that they are elected by the people in their district or in their state for the Senate. And sometimes they're going to have to, break with the president and this huge piece of legislation. I've seen these things before when I was in the House. You have to be very, very careful of it, because no matter how much you try and read them and understand it, you have your staff comb through it. There's always things hidden in there. It's not a good idea to have these huge pieces of legislation thrown at the House.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think this is what Trump wanted? Because Trump comes into office, he knows we spend too much money. He brings in Musk and his Doge team. They identify a couple of $100 billion, small amount, but a substantial chunk of the $2 trillion that we're upside down every year. They identify all this, and then none of those cuts gets incorporated into the big, beautiful bill. That can't have been Trump's preference, was it?
Well, it's hard to tell, because whether you're the president or whether you're a congressional leader, there are going to be pressures on you to put stuff in a piece of legislation or support a piece of legislation that, if you think about it more carefully and objectively, you really don't want to support. It's just too darn much money. Congress has to step up to the plate at some point. I'm not sure they will. The House seems not to really have the stomach to step up to the plate and start to at least trim back some of these spending bills, but it's got to be done pretty soon. Otherwise, it's going to get to the point, Lars, where government is just so big and so powerful that we can't trim it back.
Well, not just big and powerful, but broke. Because if we're overspending the income of the federal government by $2 trillion a year, and they can't even cut it to $1 trillion a year, and I know that both Musk and the president have talked about increasing the income coming into the government, whether it's tariffs or growing the GDP or going out and actually beginning to use the natural resources of America, get the oil, the gas, the rare earths, all of that stuff, the timber and the forests and everything else, increase the GDP of the country. But that's a slower ask than saying, in the meantime, cut the spending. And I would imagine the 435 over on the House side, they've all got constituencies at home saying, don't cut our project. Well, you're overspending the budget by $2 trillion. That has to come down. And the whole purpose of DOGE was to find a lot of the money that was being wasted. It did identify a substantial amount, and not one little bit of it made it into the budget. I can't believe that would have been Trump's preference.
It just shows you the power of government, the government bureaucracy. regardless of what the president wants, regardless of what a member of Congress or a congressional leader wants, the power of the bureaucracy can be overwhelming. And what you have to do is you have to have a president that is absolutely committed to cut spending so that he can force a Congress, particularly if it's of his own party, to start cutting back these entitlement programs. They've already broken us, and they're going to put us beyond repair if we don't do something fairly soon, Lars.
I think you're right. Let me ask you about the consent decree. So people understand this is where the government in years gone by would go to a police department or a fire department and say, you're not doing the right, you're not doing business the right way. And they would essentially say, so a federal minder is going to keep an eye on your police department and tell you how to do your business. Some of these things stay in place for more than a decade. Are they doing any good, or are they putting Americans at risk? And is it a good idea for the Trump administration to say, we're going to dump a lot of this stuff and let the cities and the states run their own operation?
If the Trump administration, if the Department of Justice under President Trump and Attorney General Bondi is serious about it, it is a very, very important move to not just stop these so-called consent decrees, whereby the Department of Justice, usually the Civil Rights Division, goes after a local police department and threatens them with an unending perpetual lawsuit if they don't agree to a consent decree that then becomes locked in, and the people in that jurisdiction lose control over their police department. If this administration doesn't stop this and start rolling these things back that the Democrat administrations love, you know, people are going to start to realize that they no longer have control of their police departments and their sheriff's department. They're in the hands of the Civil Rights Division at the U.S. Department of Justice.
And we end up with a federal police force like maybe Germany, modern Germany, to have basically one big national police force. And I don't think that. And for instance, Oakland, California, I've been through Oakland. I've never lived there. It's not exactly the best police place in America. But being under a consent decree for 12 or 13 or 14 years kind of suggests the consent decree hasn't actually fixed the problem, if there was a problem at all. And second, I think they used it as a way to push this DEI nonsense, to hire cops based on race and skin color and sexuality, instead of hiring them based on knowing how to be a good cop.
They do. It's a very insidious way that our federal government operates, whether it's under Democrats or Republicans, is you bring an action against a local police department on civil rights, whether it's age discrimination alleged or racial discrimination that's alleged, and you get the you force the police department, because they need federal support, unfortunately. We've gotten to the point where the federal money is wagging the local law enforcement dog. They have to agree to a consent decree, and you know, it takes away local control.
Absolutely right. Bob Barr, former CIA analyst and member of Congress. Bob, thanks very, very much.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. To adjust your volume. He's just that loud. Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's First Amendment Friday. House Minority Leader Representative Christine Drazen joins me now. She may have to jump out to do another vote or go set the Democrats straight on something. It's good to have you back, Rep. Drazen.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lars.
Okay, so let's start with this. Why are the Republicans allowing so many? Let's start with the anti-gun bills. We'll get the tax increase in a second. Why are you allowing all these anti-gun bills to go through when there is a way to stop them?
Yeah, we are not allowing anything. We had 7 gun bills this session, and we killed all the gun bills that were out of the House, and one gun bill made it through to the Senate.
243.
And we hate it, and absolutely not. We killed so many gun bills this session, Lars. I absolutely, absolutely fought that fight. All the Republicans did. And that gun bill that did make it through doesn't have an emergency clause. It can be referred out. And frankly, you know, it's not going to be constitutional anyway. And I think that there's opportunities there to keep fighting that fight. But we killed 6 gun bills this session. I mean, these guys have an insatiable appetite.
Yeah. Tell me this. What does it say to citizens when they pass a measure? The courts find it unconstitutional. It's Measure 114. It's now going to go to the Oregon Supreme Court, but long after the session, this session, has ended. And then your Democrat colleagues say, well, we'll just pass it as a statute and basically circumvent the whole process, moot the Supreme Court challenge, and then the opponents will have to start all over again. I mean, is that being respectful of the citizens of the state?
There's no universe where these guys respect gun owners or the voters. And that was one of the bills that was killed. And so, you know, that court challenge is moving ahead. It's moving ahead unimpeded by this Democrat supermajority that would have gone around that to put that measure into statute directly. So, you know, we're fighting every single day here. And the supermajority Democrats, we just need to beat them in elections. And along the way, we're doing everything we can to kill their bad ideas.
Okay, now what about this? Let's go to the tax issue. And that is, they now have a compromise that instead of $15 billion, the largest tax increase in state history, it's going to be, or just short of 15, it'll be just short of 12, still the largest tax increase in state history. Is that going to get stopped?
Yeah, that actually is dead now.
Oh, good.
And it's,
when did it die?
As of this morning.
Nice.
And so that is killed. Now, here's the next thing we have to fight. They have a final last gasp effort where they want to raise the gas tax by 3 cents and do it immediately. And they want to increase title and registration fees. Now, this is still a bad tax. It's a bad tax, and we're trying to kill this one. But this just goes to show how completely out of touch they are. Oregonians across the state had massive response into their offices saying, who do you think you are? Why are you doing this to us? We can't afford it. Knock it off. And it really was outcry from Oregonians. Pressure, pressure, pressure. And that bill is dead. Doesn't get any more dead than that bill. So now we still have stuff to fight. We are not done. And we are at this very moment, working to kill this last gasp as well.
Now, tell me this. Why is it that I keep hearing, even from people like Kevin Mannix, who refuses, I don't know why, years ago, Kevin just started ghosting us. We called, and we've called him on things he's in favor of, and he just started ghosting us. And I thought, well, maybe we can get him on, because he was defending this, saying, oh, we're going to make ODOT so responsible and so transparent. We're going to get them behaving right, which is actually the job of Tina Kotek. But if the legislature has to do it, fine. Is anybody actually holding ODOT to account for all the mismanagement they've done of literally billions of dollars before we hand them even more money?
Well, and that's the problem with the Democrats' approach, is they never want to hold these agencies accountable because they like what the agencies are doing. They actually are the ones that direct these agencies to squander money on things that are not roads and highways, and to spend money on trails and transit that nobody rides. And so, you know, it's not in their best interest to hold these agencies accountable. And this proposal is no better. It does absolutely nothing to hold this agency to account. It is all lip service. They have, you know, created an ongoing sort of, you know, efficiency and accountability committee. It's not real. It's fake. They've had that kind of thing in place before. It's done no good. The agency is completely unaccountable to taxpayers, and it is certainly unaccountable, you know, to Oregonians. And so this is going to be more of the same. They're going to talk about it like there's accountability in this measure. There's not.
So why is Tina Kotek, I don't know how many conversations you have with the governor, but why is she unwilling? She's the head of the executive branch. We can see an executive in D.C. who has no problem telling the agencies what to do. That's Donald Trump. She can't do, she's not even trying to do as good a job as Trump.
She's in over her head. I just think she is she's really just a mediocre legislator that just happens to have an electoral advantage in the state of Oregon that, you know, allowed her with the help of Betsy Johnson to become governor of our state. And she's in over her head. The reason that nothing has improved, the reason that we have seen scandal after scandal and issue after issue in her agencies is that she is not, in fact, a strong leader. She knows one issue, and that's housing. And the only thing she knows to do with that issue is to spend more money and build more public housing and abandon the idea that we should even have single-family homes, abandon the idea that we should even have yards. And that is her claim to fame. And I don't think it's good enough for Oregonians. And her agencies have been in disarray from the moment she took office, and she has yet to turn them around.
Well, and she's lost most of her executive crew, replaced them. She's got domestic problems, apparently, that are occupying most of her attention because of her drunken, mentally ill wife and all that. And is anybody going to call her on the carpet on this? Is her own party going to call her on it? Or is it one more of those, as you said, they like it being done that way, they're not going to get in the way?
Well, I think that when she got elected, she basically ran on this idea, I'm not Kate Brown. Well, the next person's probably going to run on the idea they're not Tina Kotek. I mean, we have a Democrat Party that is so entrenched that they believe that they're entitled to these offices year after year after year, and all you have to do is say, I'm not the last guy. Oh, but by the way, I'm still a Democrat. And it's Oregonians are going to be the ones that are going to have to change that. They're the only ones that can change their mind about how we approach these statewide offices. Their party is not going to do it. It's got to be the non-affiliated voters that are putting Democrats in office. And there comes a time where people have to look around and say, what we've been doing isn't working. We have got to do something different if we're going to get the state back on track. Oregonians are sick of it. They're frustrated. No matter where they live in the state, they recognize scandal. And they absolutely recognize that this government isn't serving them. It's super expensive. And you're getting almost no return on that investment. So we have another opportunity, but we're not there yet.
Okay. And as you mentioned, housing is one of her big things. Real quick, I want to ask you a last question. She promised to double the amount of housing being built. It's dropped in half instead from where she started. Is anybody going to, certainly the news media isn't calling her on it. Is anybody in the legislature going to call her on it?
We have been calling her on it all the time. The thing is, it's not being picked up. We need to sound the alarm. And not only that, if you look at what she has built, you say, okay, what does it cost per door, you know, per unit for where somebody's going to live? We're talking about those things costing $250,000 to $750,000 per unit. It's insane how much money she's throwing at this. Hundreds and hundreds of millions and over the $1 billion mark every session. And she's not getting the job done.
Unbelievable. That is Christine Drazen, the House Minority Leader from the Oregon Legislature, which thankfully has to wrap up by Sunday night. Glad to have you with me and always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Check out our Instagram feed and our other social media. And you can always tell Alexa to play the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. When he talks, you have no choice but to listen. More with Lars. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. I guess a lot of us got a real wake-up call about 5 years, 4 to 5 years ago during the pandemic when we saw all these edicts go out saying you cannot evict people from their apartments or their homes, even though they're not paying, even if they're being obnoxious to their fellow renters, you can't kick them out. And what happened right after that? Well, we had some people taking over homes. Now, it has always been the case that occasionally you'd have cases of squatting. And then it became a social media phenomena where there were squatters who literally said, here's how to get a free house. And here's the way to occupy a house. Here are the answers you give when the police show up and ask you to leave. If they do, here's what you do when the landlord or the owner of the house shows up. Well, when squatters take over a home, should the police be allowed to remove them immediately so the owners don't have to pay ransom or wait months for court? Kyle Sweetland is a strategic research manager at Pacific Legal Foundation. Kyle, welcome back to the program.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Are we seeing this problem finally get fixed, at least in some parts of America?
Yeah, so actually, since 2024, there have been 8 states that have passed a model Stop Squatters Act. This has allowed property owners to go through a much faster process to regain possession of their home. Prior to that, only about 8 states have actually had some sort of legislation in place that did that, and the rest of the states didn't.
But still, it's only 8 out of 50, 58 if you're an Obama fan, but 50 states, and only 8 of them have done that. Any reason why the other 42 have not?
May just be taking them some time to see how big of an issue this really is in their community.
I mean, because even if it's only one house and one squatter, for the person who owns that house and has a right to it, you would think it'd be a major problem and they'd want to get on top of it. Plus, the very idea that somebody would simply take over another person's home and that the police are powerless to act on that, I would think that would trouble almost anybody, even liberals.
Yeah, you certainly would. And it really is quite a bipartisan issue, we've found. Property owners can experience significant delays on average. In most states I've seen, it takes between 6 months and 2 years to have a civil court case go through. And during that time, a property owner can't live in their home. The squatters are the ones who are actually being protected by the law, because the law sees them as a legal tenant when in fact they aren't.
Well, and if
a criminal trespasser.
Do you think that local law enforcement agencies, look, I'm a big fan of the cops most of the time, but I think that police will occasionally say, we don't want to be in the middle of this one. Somebody else is occupying your property. The property is then denied for your use. Somebody who is not likely to take good care of the property is now occupying it and is costing the owner of that property at least thousands of dollars, maybe more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Are there ways, and you're the research manager, are there ways for the law to be used and the police are simply avoiding it because their city council or their county commission or their state has said, we really don't want to be in the middle of this one, even though there might be legal tools we could use to help out the owner of the property?
Yeah, the resources, that the police have are somewhat limited in determining, is this actually a legal tenant or not. But a lot of times police just don't want to necessarily get involved because there is a lot of protections for tenants in the law. And if they accidentally removed someone who was a tenant, that would be obviously a very bad PR day for the police department. So a lot of police are really hesitant to get involved and simply are more likely to defer to the courts to resolve these matters.
So in other words, have to pass a law to fix this problem and give the police the tool or give the police the direction you will go and solve this problem.
Yeah, it gives the police a way out. And so in a lot of ways, there's in these models legislation that we've been talking about, there's an affidavit that the property owner actually signs and says, if I'm not actually telling you the truth, this is actually a tenant, that problem is on me. It's not on anybody else.
And it'd be perjury.
The property owner's taking on the responsibility.
I mean, if I signed a document saying I'm the owner of this house, this person is not now and never has been a tenant before, and I'm lying in that document and I sign it, I think I'm committing false swearing, which is the written version of perjury, and there'd be a criminal penalty. And as long as the owners of properties know that, I would expect they'd have an incentive to tell the truth, because if the squatter doesn't tell the truth, he just goes on down the road and finds another empty home. But if the owner of a property mm-hmm. doesn't tell the truth, the police know where to find him, and probably through the property records, and they're going to haul him off to jail.
Yeah, that's very true.
Now, my understanding is, does Florida now allow immediate removal of squatters if they're identified by the owner?
I believe Florida's law is very similar to Georgia's, and I know Georgia's law a little bit better. In Georgia, it allows the affidavit to be signed by the property owner, kind of like I was telling you before, and then the court will take up to a week to determine, is this person actually a tenant or not, based on the evidence that they provide. And if they can't prove that, then the court gives the police the go-ahead to remove this person. And that can take less than 10 days to do.
I can imagine. I long time ago was a property owner of a duplex, and I had 10 years of experience doing it. People, I guess, don't appreciate that if you lose the rent from a tenant because it's occupied by a squatter, you never get that money back. And if people say, no, but you rented the next month, you say, yeah, but the month you missed, that is gone forever. Meaning you've lost that money and nobody's going to make it up, because I would imagine most of the people who are the squatters are pretty much judgment proof and you can't do much to them. Kyle, thank you very much. That's Kyle Sweetland from the Pacific Legal Foundation.
The Lars Larson Show.
Arthur Murray.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails in a moment. Well, President Trump's budget slashes science funding like never before, cutting research, environmental programs, and public health down to size. Is that smart spending or a disaster waiting to happen? I have a feeling I know where Dr. Henry Miller is going to go on this. Doc is a medical doctor, molecular biologist. He's currently at the American Council on Science and Health. Dr. Miller, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Lars. Thank you.
Henry, am I right in guessing that you don't like these cuts to science funding? And then we have to get into the question of whether or not science funded by the government is not already a bit problematic.
Well, you know the old expression, Lars, about throwing the baby out with the bathwater?
Yes.
This budget that's proposed by the administration is sort of like throwing out not only the baby, but the baby's five siblings and 13 cousins. It's gutting important research agencies. Apparently, by Elon Musk's munchkins at Doge, who don't understand the importance of basic research or how some of these agencies operate.
But do they own some of the reputation that came along with it? I mean, in the same way, Henry, that if I watch somebody spending money on behalf of his family or on behalf of his company or his organization, and I saw him spending on some foolish things, am I free to believe that, well, maybe he makes bad decisions about how to spend money? And you say, well, that's not all he spent money on. He also spent some money on some worthy things as well. Yes, but the decisions that I can see and the ones that gained a lot of attention suggested that a lot of America, maybe it wasn't even the majority of the money, was being spent foolishly. Then why should we trust the rest of those results?
Well, there's supposed to be oversight of how these things are spent.
By whom?
By effective managers. You get rid of the managers and you make them live on a budget that is reasonable and that gets rid of DEI and gets rid of a lot of nonsensical social spending. But you can't cut the NIH $48 billion budget by $21 billion and expect that it's going to be done intelligently,
okay,
without damage.
Dr. Miller, let me point out that until Trump came along in his first term, and I've told people there are things I disagree with Trump about, and I say so, but in his first term, he wanted to make it possible to fire federal employees who weren't doing their jobs, whether it was at the VA or anywhere else. Before that, we had decades where the law effectively said you can't fire people even when they're doing their job badly. And that's where you could prove they were doing their job badly. And now more recently, when Trump has tried to fire people, you've had federal courts come in and say, no, you may be the head of the executive branch, but you can't fire people. So when you say you should have effective management from people, well, most of the reason that people are effective in managing their jobs is because they know there's a consequence if they don't. Well, if they find out over the decades there is no effective consequence because you can't be fired, some of them will go out and go crazy and do stupid things saying, I'm doing this stuff, and people may disagree, but they can't fire me.
Well, but I agree that you have to be able to fire people. You know, I've written about some of the idiocy that I encountered at FDA.
You've talked about it here.
Yeah, I've talked about it here. One elderly secretary who would give me phone messages such as so-and-so called, phone number 235-547. But, Tom Frieden, the former CDC director, I think said it very well recently. He said, you don't improve things by destroying them. You improve them by improving them. And there hasn't been a systematic effort to weed out the bad and emphasize the good in these budgets. And look, I'm for cutting some of these, even research entirely at some agencies. EPA has not done good research over the years. And I've written about that and I've complained about that. And goodbye, Office of Research and Development at EPA, and goodbye to much of what's claimed to be research at the Department of Education.
You mean like putting sand fleas on the eyes of beagles and things like that?
Well, I can't judge what the purpose of that experiment was.
Shrimp on treadmills? Was there? If you used your wildest scientific imagination, could you imagine a reason to put shrimp on treadmills?
Not really.
Okay.
Not really.
I guess what I'm wondering, Doc, is when you've got an institution, and this can't be a secret. I mean, the first time some scientist says, hey, you know what Henry's doing down the hall? He's got shrimp on treadmills underwater. You would think that the word would go out and say, okay, whoever signed off on that, you're gone. Unfireable people are tough to manage. But how do you manage it when the institution just seems to nod and go, yeah, I know, sand fleas on eyeballs, shrimp on treadmills. Okay, whatever. We fund everything. Because seemed to be when the whole institution buys into it and nobody within the scientific community, within those institutions, is raising a hue and cry saying, we're spending money on stupid stuff instead of the important stuff.
Well, but it's not all stupid stuff, and that's the important thing. You know, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, innovation doesn't come from government-supported research. It comes from companies. It comes from Apple.
And individuals.
And individuals.
Because otherwise, which government bureaucracy came up with the light bulb or the telephone or the phonograph or any of those things?
But let me tell you about my own experience. When I was a grad student, improbably, I came up with two significant discoveries. One was I discovered the RNA polymerase, the enzyme in influenza virus that enables it to replicate. And there's now a drug that's focused on that enzyme called baloxavir that's a common anti-flu drug. You know, that I didn't do the drug development. I didn't get paid for whatever company by whatever company eventually did, and then later I discovered an enzyme called ribonuclease H that's essential to DNA replication, and that's the kind of stuff pre-commercial that comes out of NIH. Mainly NIH-supported research, and also the National Science Foundation does similar important things. So I'm a great believer in it, but it needs to be vetted. It needs to be vetted by experts who fund the good things and reject the bad things.
And I couldn't agree with you more on that. The problem is when they're signing off on the bad things, even if the bad things are only 10% of it, it kind of suggests that I don't trust their judgment. Dr. Miller, thanks very much. That's Dr. Henry Miller from the American Council on Science and Health, founding director of the FDA's Office of Biotechnology.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
At summergunlaw.com.
The Zoom meeting you
actually want to be at. This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I want to talk about the state of Washington and what a brand new report card tells us about the state's prospects right now. And the man who put that together is Todd Myers, Vice President for Research with the Washington Policy Center. Todd, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
So you put together a report card. Did we get all passing grades at the very least, or are some of them less than passing?
Yeah, one of the reason that we put this together at the Washington Policy Center, it wasn't just me, it was our whole team, was that we wanted to give people a sense of how things are really going, because when you live in a state, you don't necessarily know whether things are going well or poorly because you live it every day. And we wanted to let people know, here's how we're doing compared to other states. And it won't surprise you that Washington is doing very poorly. We think of ourselves in Washington State as sort of being superior and above the rest, but in many areas we are absolutely failing. And I'll just give you one good example. 12 years ago, Washington, according to the Tax Foundation, which is a national independent organization, ranked Washington as having the sixth best business tax climate. So if you wanted to start a business, sixth best in the country. In the last 12 years, we have fallen to 46th. So from near the top to almost to the bottom. And we have gone from a situation where companies were moving here to now where they're moving out. I think that would surprise people to realize how bad it has gotten, but that's exactly why we did the report card.
Well, and in fact, I think you're right that people do look. I live in Washington State. I may have a bias, but I like Oregon as well. And yet both states, you know, they're very proud of things like Nike in the case of Oregon, Microsoft and Boeing in the case of Washington State. And yet there's a lot more than just the, you know, the big national or international namesake companies. And what happens when you start to make things unfriendly for those companies, even Boeing, which years ago said, we'll open up another assembly line on the right coast of America. And they offered the state a choice and the labor a choice as well, saying we'd like to build it here. And the union said, we aren't going to guarantee you union peace. So they said, okay, we'll build a separate assembly line. I would think that the writing would have been on the wall at that point. You're making the place unfriendly for business, and that's both labor and the actions of government.
And it's not just Boeing. Amazon opened a second headquarters because of the challenges that they were facing. Amazon, you know, had their headquarters in Seattle. Now they are moving more people to Bellevue. So even when they're staying in the state, they're moving, you know, from an unfriendly place to a more business-friendly city. But we look at other things in the report card, too. We look at transportation. So, for instance, today is the first day of the new 6 cents per gallon gas tax. Washington has the third highest gas taxes in the country behind California and Pennsylvania. And look, people, you know, they want to have good roads. They're willing to pay for good roads. Here's the problem. What our report card shows is that according to the U.S. Department of Transportation, Washington ranks 43rd in the nation in the number of and the percentage of roads that are considered acceptable. So we pay the third highest gas taxes and we rank 43rd in terms of road quality. Those are the sorts of facts that people need to realize. Now, average people wouldn't necessarily know how Washington ranked compared to others, but they need to know when they make those decisions and when they are talking to their politicians about, you know, why aren't things getting done? We're spending money, but we're not getting the results.
Well, and in fact, Todd, one of the other measures, and I haven't seen it for years, I used to see comparisons of, say, since you brought up roads, they bring up, what does it cost per lane mile, or, you know, the various measures that would allow you to compare apples to apples? New Mexico, Iowa, you know, Florida, Texas, whatever, all compare to all the states and say, how much are we spending per lane mile? And oftentimes there were gigantic differences, even though the wage rates and the materials rates in those different states were not that different at all. And you understand why Alaska is more expensive because of transportation, Hawaii probably the same. But why would there be gigantic differences, say, between Idaho and the state of Oregon or state of Washington, in things like that? And you'd almost think it would suggest the solution. That if you say, if they're getting roads paved for this much and we're paying, you know, 30% more, let's figure out why and see if we can get to that number instead. Is that an approach to maybe solving that problem?
That's exactly right, and I can give you an example. We don't have, you know, cost per mile, but we do have another cost, which is in King County, they want to build a light rail to West Seattle. It's only about, I think, 6 miles, but the cost per mile is the highest for any light rail system in the world.
Even higher than the Interstate Bridge light rail at $1 billion a mile? That's amazing.
Yes. Yeah, wow. It's remarkable, isn't it? So, and there's no bridge, right? I mean, it is just going to West Seattle, and yet they have found a way to make it the most expensive per mile in the world. So these are the sorts of things, again, people need to realize. I'll give you one other fun one, which is that we take, you know, we have technology. We take education very seriously. At least we talk about it a lot. But in the most recent national test scores, Washington's fourth graders have been surpassed by Mississippi in reading competence, yep, and reading testing. So I think if you told most people, especially in King County, that Mississippi was doing a better job at teaching its kids reading than Washington State, I think they'd be stunned. But that's what the data shows. Again, we spend a lot. We talk a lot about how important it is, but we're just not getting the results.
Well, and it's how you spend it, because, Todd, if you'll forgive me, I've been fascinated with Mississippi for the last couple, 3 years. I talked to the governor of the state a few years ago of Mississippi, a governor of Oregon, Governor Washington won't talk to me. And I said, how are you doing this? How'd you? And they went from bottom of the pile nationwide to, I would think, about the middle now. And now in some categories, they're in the top 10. And he said it was pretty simple. They said you put up a third grade gate. If a kid gets to third grade, to the end of third grade, and they're not ready to do fourth grade work, they're held back, but they're given tutoring to try to bring them up to speed. If they can be brought up to speed, they go on to fourth grade. If they can't, they get held back a year. Now, I know that liberals are aghast at the idea of holding somebody back or advancing somebody forward, but I said, what are you spending? And by the way, Mississippi has a population of about 3 million. Washington State is about double that. And I said, what are you spending every year on tutoring? They said about $30 million. Todd, $30 million is chump change. It's a rounding error down in Olympia. But if you said, if we could just give the kids some tutoring and tell them, if you're not ready for fourth grade, we're going to hold you back for a year, and you could solve much of the problem by doing that, why aren't you doing it? And I wish I knew the answer to that.
Well, and the key to that, the first step is, like in an A12-step program, step one is admit you have a problem. And I think in Washington State, we don't even admit that we have a problem with education, with transportation, with business climate, and things like that. That's what the report card is about saying, look, we have problems, and they're serious. We are not doing well, and they need to be addressed.
Okay, Todd, where can people find it? Very quick.
Just washingtonpolicy.org, and you go for the report card for Washington State, and it's there, and we cover a variety of issues, business climate, taxes, education, transportation, environments. It's all there.
Washington Policy Center. Thanks very much, Todd. I appreciate it. That's Todd Byers from Washington Policy. You're welcome to weigh in. 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you're a naysayer, you'll always go first on the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Lars Larson Show. Because you can't get enough Lars. Podcast every show at LarsLarson.com. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. You know, the president has ordered limits on woke agendas, but around America, schools are still pushing radical grading changes under the radar, even keeping parents in the dark about what's going on. Dr. Lance Izumi joins me now, senior director of the Center for Education and author of The Great Classroom Collapse, Teachers, Students, and Parents Expose the Collapse of Learning in America's Schools. Dr. Izumi, welcome back.
Thanks very much, Lars. Always a great pleasure to be on your program.
Thank you, sir. Is there a concerted effort to continue the DEI kind of agenda in American schools and maybe push it further under the radar so parents and even students are not aware of it?
Absolutely, Lars. I mean, it's going on all across the country. I mean, most Americans by now have heard about the total fiasco that occurred in San Francisco, where they were pushing an equity grading system that would have reduced the benchmarks for, you know, what you would get an A for down to, like, for example, getting a C for just 41 out of 100 points on a test, for example, which I'm sure in your and my day, that was a fail, not a C.
Yep.
And then, you know, not being marked down for not turning in homework or turning in assignments late, and then being able to retake tests multiple times, you know, if you did poorly. So what that does is, of course, it disincentivizes students from trying hard and learning the material. And that's, but you know, the important thing is that that is not just a system that is, you know, relegated to a very progressive place like San Francisco. It's all across the country. You have that type of grading system being used, you know, in the Midwest, in the South, and in the East Coast. So it's all over the country. And unfortunately, the students are the ones that are being shortchanged for it, because what you find out is that this grading system has no evidence that it's going to actually improve their performance on standardized tests, even though it inflates the grades of these students immensely. Because, of course, you know, if you're getting high grades for relatively low scores on a scaling system, you're going to have a lot of A's and B's and very few F's. But that doesn't tell you anything about, you know, whether those students are learning the material or not.
Well, in fact, Dr. Azumi, it seems like the most direct beneficiaries of this are either teachers in the classrooms or the politicians who control the school systems, because it means the teachers can produce a lower quality product. And if somebody said, well, but so can the students. Well, yeah, they can, but that doesn't benefit them. That hurts them. But for the teacher who only has to make certain, see that students are making certain marks, they can run around and brag to the voters, look how many kids have graduated from our system. Look how many diplomas we handed out. That benefits the teachers, benefits some of the politicians who support this nonsense, and hurts the kids, doesn't it?
It absolutely does, Lars. And that's why, for example, if you look at this San Francisco fiasco, now they've had to backtrack, but what they tried to do is that they tried to, the superintendent and the district bureaucracy tried to ramrod this plan through, basically under cover of darkness, so that not just the public, but even the elected school board members didn't really know that this was what was going to occur in the classroom. And so therefore, you know, you would end up having a fait accompli being foisted upon the public, and they would have to accept this grading system, which, as you say, would have had the end result that of making the district and the teachers and all the others look good, because, hey, we've got lots of kids now getting A's and B's, and aren't we doing a great job, when in reality, it's the same failed product coming out of the public education system, only dressed up in social justice rhetoric.
Well, and it seems like a really good citizen advocate, whether it's teachers or somebody on their behalf, or parents or somebody on their behalf, would say, if you're going to tell us that a lower standard is being set for the quality of the product, then we're not going to want to pay as much money to get it, the same way you would with any other product or service. And there are lots of examples of that. If you said, well, if you want to get that airline flight cheaper, don't fly first class, fly back in coach. And if you say, I'm happy to fly back in coach, but they say, but you're still going to pay first class prices, then you're going to say, hold on a second, you can't charge me for the high quality product and then hand me the bad quality product. But are there any real active groups out there pushing that to say, we're now being told you're going to pay top dollar for the teachers and their benefits and everything else, and you're going to accept a low quality output?
Well, there are, Lars. There are actually a lot of parent groups out there who are actually pushing for greater accountability and greater rigor in the academic programs at school. I mean, even a place like San Francisco, again, very progressive area, obviously, but the parents in that school district actually were responsible for, forcing the school district to back off of their attempt to water down math instruction there. They, you know, forced the district basically to offer algebra in the eighth grade instead of the ninth grade as the district wanted, you know, out of woke concerns, not out of, you know, whether the students would actually perform better or not. And so I think that what you're seeing is that parents are demanding accountability from their school officials to provide that type of rigorous education that their kids need in order to be successful. And, you know, whether they're in conservative, moderate, or progressive areas, I think all parents really want their kids to do well in their livelihoods, and they're only going to do that if they have control over their education.
By the way, there's part of the way that this is being reported on that I want to ask you about, Dr. Izumi, because they say, and I think this is from San Fran Voice, the plan comes during the last week of spring semester while parents are assessing the impact of $100 million in budget reductions and deciding whether to remain in public schools this fall or to keep their kids there. But I suspect they didn't actually reduce the budget, $100 million. What they did was they paid the teachers more, and they said, now that we're paying each teacher more, we have to cut a bunch of personnel. It's not as though San Francisco schools spent $4.1 billion last year, and now this year they're going to spend $4 billion, $100 million less. They're going to spend more money, but they're just saying we have to cut $100 million in expenses. That's not a budget cut. That's an expense cut, and I think there's a big difference. If I told you, doctor, that I was going to move to a less expensive apartment, and you say, well, how much are you paying now? $3,000 a month. Well, what are you going to move to? I'm going to go to $2,800 a month. I can't afford more than that. That would be an actual reduction. But if I said, well, I'm going to have to do, you know, $100 change in my monthly budget. And you say, why? Well, because my apartment costs me $100 a month more, so I've got to cut $100 out of something else. That's where they say it in a way that's deceptive, as though the school district is spending less money. No, they're spending more money. They're just spending less money on the things they have to cut to afford the raises they handed to teachers. Am I right?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Lars. I mean, the important point for everybody to realize is that it's not how much money you're spending, it's how you're spending the money. Because, I mean, that $4 billion figure that you quote is gets a lot of money, of course, you know. I mean, the school budget, especially in a large metropolitan area like San Francisco, are huge. And, you know, if you look at where that money is going, a lot of it is going to places that is not going to affect student achievement, actually become barriers to it. I mean, you know, in the terms of this equity grading, for example, you know, even though the district is supposedly running a budget deficit, they were willing to spend over $170,000 to hire a consultant to teach the teachers how to do equity grading. Well, if you're in a deficit, why are you spending this money on this consultant to teach the teachers a method of grading that is going to actually be worse for the children? And that's the kind of thing where taxpayers, as you point out, taxpayers look at that and say, well, why am I paying taxes for something crazy like that?
Yeah, because if you're telling me that you've supplied me with well-compensated teachers, if they're well-compensated, they should be, you know, they should be trained appropriately to teach the class. If you have to bring in an outside consultant for anything, let alone to teach the teachers how to go with some kind of a lower standard. That is Dr. Lance Izumi, Senior Director at the Center for Education and the author of The Great Classroom Collapse. Dr. Izumi, thank you very much. I appreciate the call.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
What are you doing?
LarsLarson.com. He actually reads them. More with Lars right now. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. But I've been really looking forward to talking to Jonathan Cho, who is an independent journalist. He works with the Discovery Institute. And Jonathan, when I first sent the notes to my producers, hey, we got to get Jay Cho on to talk about this, it was about something that now seems like old news because it's from a week ago. So I don't know if we want to start with the assault that is beginning by protesters workers on the federal building in downtown Seattle? Or should we first deal with the fact that Microsoft headquarters in Seattle or Redmond is not going to bring back one of its biggest developer conferences to Seattle because the people who came to the conference said Seattle's too dangerous and too dirty? Where should we start?
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, the news cycle it remains unpredictable, and of course it's dominated by riot season right now. But let's talk about what's going on with this Microsoft Build conference in Seattle. I mean, the news just broke actually a few days ago, actually last Friday, and now mainstream media is starting to pick up on this gigantic news. So we can go there right now, Lars.
Well, and in fact, wouldn't this be a big deal? You've got all these developers, and by that I mean, I take it you mean people who design computer programs. It's a gigantic business. It's worth hundreds of billions of dollars, and the big daddy of all is going to be Microsoft, even though most of us have our problems with Microsoft as a company and its, you know, founder and Gates and all that. But they say, okay, we're going to have a developer conference and we'll have it in our home city. And at the end of the conference, what was the reaction of the people who came to this Microsoft developer conference?
Yeah, that Seattle was unsafe, unclean, too many homeless encampments, and too much open-air drug use. Pretty much everything that I've been reporting on now for more than, you know, 6 years here in Seattle, and I've been covering Mayor Bruce Harrell's administration now for almost 4 years he's been in office. So he's had 4 years to deal with this, Lars, and that's what's so frustrating for so many business owners, business leaders I've been talking to, especially Visit Seattle, the, again, Visitors Bureau, putting out this email saying that, yeah, this is an epic failure and a massive loss. More than 4,000 people coming through downtown Seattle, and the mayor's team couldn't get this situation handled. Just clean the place up for the visitors for a week. But they couldn't even do that.
I don't even know what the current number is. It used to be, Jonathan, that I would talk to visitors associations and they'd say, well, if we have a visitor coming to town, this is probably 20 years ago, we figure they're going to spend around $1,000 a day. So you take 4,000 people coming to your town, and if each one of them spends, you know, in a period of time, thousands of dollars times 4,000 people, that's a major boost to a city. And to lose it, and I imagine it sends a message to other conventions as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, and keep in mind, these are the so-called tech elites. These are the top-notch AI programmers, developers, people not only locally here in the Seattle area, but nationally and globally, who come to Seattle. And now organizers are saying they're out of Seattle, and they're now considering Las Vegas and even San Francisco, a city that was dealing with you know, a horrible drug crisis, still is, but at least San Francisco is willing to clean up the downtown core for these big conferences. We saw that when China's Xi Jinping came last year, and of course Gavin Newsom and the mayor at the time, London Breed, cleaned up the entire city, and it went off without a hitch. And at the very least, Microsoft knows San Francisco and Vegas will do that.
I want to ask you, let's move on to the riots for just a moment, because this is a serious hit, and I think people in Portland and other parts of the Northwest can appreciate the same kind of thing is happening in other big, dirty cities that have terrible downtowns like Portland does now. And I think that's unfortunate. My wife and I used to love to go to downtown Seattle, downtown Portland. We kind of avoid the places now because they're dirty, they're dangerous, and they show all the signs of complete neglect. It's like going to somebody's house that's a dirty house, disorganized, clutter and garbage everywhere, and you say, we don't want to go back there. If the mayors of those cities and the lawmakers from those states don't understand that's how people react, then they need to wise up or get out of that office. Let's talk about the riots, though. And what I'm most concerned about is we've had four nights now, probably a fifth night tonight, of rioting, and we've got the promise that there are gigantic things planned for both Portland and Seattle in the next days ahead. Are we going to have to brace for another 2020-style summer of love?
I personally think it's going to be worse than the BLM riots from roughly 5 years ago. I have never seen this type of violence targeting police officers by so many people. And I'm talking about what we've been seeing now for five straight days in L.A. And right now, as we speak, outside the Seattle Federal Building, an Antifa mob has blocked all of the doors, the entrances, because they're trying to prevent ICE agents from taking the illegals who have been apprehended into custody right now. So there's a developing story right now. I actually just got off a plane, Lars, so I'm going to be heading there right now. But my colleague Katie Davis Court over at the Post Millennial, she's been reporting about this right now, but I'm watching some of her coverage. And you have SPD on the scene. You have ICE agents trapped inside the federal building because they're not being let out. And the hope now is that these Antifa militants and far-left activists will be apprehended and pushed out of the way. But this is just the beginning, Lars. Tomorrow night, Wednesday evening, Cal Anderson Park, Antifa militants, along with the socialists and the Marxists, they've called for a similar L.A.-style riot in Seattle to stand with their comrades in Los Angeles. So this is just the beginning.
Jonathan Cho, thanks very much. Glad to be with you. Always glad to take your phone calls and emails.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. You know, the government forces banks every single day to report cash deals. And a lot of those are everyday cash deals. They're not extraordinary. They're certainly not illicit. But it turns your finances into open books. So, do they need to protect us, or are we giving up a little bit of our security, or to get a little bit of security, we're giving up our liberties? Luke Wake joins me now, who's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. Hey, Luke, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
How do you figure out the right line to draw between keeping an eye on financial transactions that could be involving drugs or human trafficking and other things, and yet at the same time not snooping so far that you start to intrude into the liberties that average Americans, law-abiding Americans, enjoy?
A couple of things on that. One, we have a constitution, and that has to be the first answer to the question is we have a government that of the people, and the government cannot just the Congress that we elect cannot just hand over its power to make law on these important questions. Congress actually has to resolve these difficult questions. They're difficult questions, but at the end of the day, however complicated they are, we expect our elected representatives to actually make the hard decisions instead of, in this case, handing a blank check to the Secretary of Treasury just to sort all of that out.
And that's the Bank Secrecy Act is what you're talking about, right?
Yes, the Federal Bank Secrecy Act delegates, Congress has given really a blank check to the Secretary of Treasury to make any rules, require reporting on any consumer transactions. It's often thought about just, when you withdraw or make deposits into a bank. No, not just that. The Secretary of Treasury can require under this statute any business that it deems a financial institution, and it can deem any business a financial institution, to collect information on its customers and to file reports with the federal government. And so what we have is the system of government surveillance on ordinary transactions. Here we're talking about cash, real estate deals, which happen every day. There's nothing unusual about that. And under this authority, they could extend that to the hot dog vendor in New York City and say, hey, I want you to write reports about every time anyone buys anything from you, and send this to this federal agency, which will act as sort of an all-seeing eye on the view that any information they can get about any transaction can help them paint a bigger picture and essentially help them pursue any sort of possible criminal issue, tax evasion, any regulatory violations, you name it.
Now, this is in place right now. Is there any chance we can get the Republican Congress to revoke this or rescind it?
Well, the Bank Secrecy Act has been around since the 1970s, and it was amended with the Patriot Act in 2001. I mean, I think it would be I would be a little surprised if you were to see some sort of legislative fix on this. I'm not saying never, but what I can say right now is that I'm actually bringing a lawsuit on behalf of a title insurance company.
Yeah, I want you to tell my audience, this is a family business down in Texas, right?
Correct, yes. They help people close real estate deals, which we all appreciate. Anyone who's bought a house uses the service of these sort of title companies to close these deals. And the new regulations from a federal agency called FinCEN under the Department of Treasury is requiring these title companies to collect just all sorts of information about anyone involved in these transactions and to report. And, you know, by the way, this is stuff that's happened at the local level. This is not traditionally an area the federal government has any business, you know, sticking its nose into. But nonetheless, we have under this very open-ended delegation from Congress and the Bank Secrecy Act, we have the Secretary of Treasury dictating these rules that is requiring these title companies to basically do government surveillance on local real estate transactions.
And by the way, Treasury demanded of East Texas Title that companies report all non-financed real estate transactions. So these would be cash deals, right? Not where you're going and obtaining a mortgage, but where somebody walks in, I've sold my old house, I have this money, I'm going to buy a new house, and I'll write you a check. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, a cash deal in the sense that you have money in the bank already. Maybe you've sold your house, maybe you have inherited wealth, maybe you've just built up a lot of savings and you've been working really hard and you're looking for some place to invest it. There's a lot of legitimate reasons. And there's also a lot of legitimate reasons why people want to, you know, maintain confidentiality. There's people who may be a domestic abuse victims or whatnot who want to, you know, go through pains to make sure that they can't be tracked down where they live. So maybe they put their property in a trust. And, of course, that's also a very common estate planning thing to do for tax reasons, to put your estate, your real estate, in a trust. Well, all of that has to now be reported to the federal government.
And is it disclosable to, I mean, are these going to become public records, or will the government agencies use them? I mean, that's bad enough. But if they were then disclosed to anybody outside of the government, then that's a problem too, isn't it?
Well, surely. And we live in an age when the Pentagon has been hacked, right? So yep. Cybersecurity is always an issue. To answer your question, the records are maintained in the government database. They're there to help law enforcement in theory, and law enforcement will always want more and more information on all of us. But that's what it exists. But there has been a lot of concerns. Certainly my clients have concerns about the security of that data, because it implicates, you know, private information about their clients, and they don't want to have to turn that over upset their clients in the process.
So you're suing on their behalf, on the behalf of East Texas Title, saying they shouldn't have to disclose this stuff unless the government provides some probable cause or reasonable suspicion to believe that there's something illegal about the transaction, right?
That's right. So there's a handful of constitutional issues here, but that's one of them, is that the Fourth Amendment protects us against the government just demanding that we hand over information without a warrant. If the government suspects that, and they're doing this again for law enforcement purposes, not for any sort of, you know, regulatory purpose other than to gather information to build, you know, seek out potential criminal activities. If they think that there's criminal issues going on, the burden is on the government under the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution to make an show something on an individualized basis to establish probable cause. The police cannot just search your home, your car, your business records without probable cause for thinking that you're actually up to something specifically.
Right.
And here they're saying we don't need that. We're going to say that there's we can mandate reporting systematically of an entire sort of transaction because some people out there might be bad actors. But that's not the way the Constitution works.
No, what they should have to do is go to a judge, say, Your Honor, we've got broad probable cause to believe that this is a suspicious transaction by a terrorist organization, by somebody who's trying to hide money from another illicit business like drugs or human trafficking or something. And then, having provided that proof to the judge can hand them a warrant and they can go seek out the records. But in the meantime, I wish you well with this, Luke. I hope you win the case, and thanks for the time.
No, I'm pleased to be here, and thank you so much. We will continue this fight forward.
That is Luke Wake, who is an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Right on the left coast. Get it? Here's Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Before I get back to your phone calls and emails, I've got to get somebody on to talk about this story because I can't be the only person who was stunned at the idea that there was a case made that a number of families from North and Northeast Portland had been disadvantaged. And how? Because their parents and grandparents had owned homes and they were taken from, the homes were taken from them under what's known as eminent domain. Now, in eminent domain, you have to be paid the fair market value of the property if the government decides to take it. I've got my own disagreements with eminent domain. I think it should be done only for essential public purposes, but, you know, with the courts and the Supreme Court and the Kelo decision, they've decided, no, we can do it for any public purpose. So this was done decades and decades ago, and these black families brought a lawsuit, a federal lawsuit, and said, look, we are owed money because if our parents had not been forced to sell their homes, why, those homes would be worth a lot of money today, and we've missed out on all of that. So they brought the lawsuit, and I want to talk to Richard Cheverton about that, who's author of Substack, known as Portland Dissent, who, fascinating read. You should sit down and spend 30 minutes reading it, which I did over the last weekend. And it was fascinating because, Richard, you make the case, before we even get to the craziness of a $2 million settlement that turns into an $8 million payment, let's start with the first fact, and that is, would this case have gone anywhere if it had actually gone to trial?
Well, that's a very good question. We'll never know because the city council stepped in and kind of turned off the legal aspect of it. I did a lot of research into whether or not people who are vaguely related to people whose homes were bought can actually go back to court and make the kind of claim that these people were making. And it seemed pretty clear to me that the Supreme Court had said, no, you can't take a double dip. We don't play it that way.
Well, and in fact, you made the point, the Supreme Court itself has seen a number of cases where somebody who's a parent or a child or a grandchild or a cousin or a nephew or somebody else says, hey, you took my family member's property under eminent domain. You wrote him a check or her a check, and I think more was owed, so you have to pay it to me. That the Supreme Court has just said, no, the person who actually has the property and owns it and has it taken under eminent domain, they get compensation. Nobody else does. And that's a longstanding Supreme Court precedent, right?
I agree with you on that. You know, the other irony in this whole thing is that it wasn't all people of color who were being whose homes were being condemned to build a larger hospital. About 22, I think it was, percent of the people who lived in Albina were white. And so that kind of knocks the props under. The essential argument of this case was, we can't go back and double dip, but this really wasn't about the hospital. It was about trying to wipe out the black community in Portland.
And that was the accusation. Was there factual backup for the idea that the powers that be at the time, a long time ago, said, look, let's go in and wipe out a neighborhood because it's populated mostly by black people? Was that true? Or was it true that the hospital system, Emmanuel, said we need to expand, we need space, and we need to get it now before it's too late, and we want to go out and do it through eminent domain? Was their goal bigger and better hospital service, or let's wipe out the black community?
Well, you know, Lars, during that period of time, urban renewal was a very big deal, a big federal program. There was tons of money available. And it wasn't just the Albina neighborhood that was singled out. for a very large scale condemnation. 1,400 households and businesses along the route of the Mount Hood Freeway, which is now Powell Boulevard.
Yep.
They were targeted and actually bought out.
Yep.
And if you drive along Powell, you will see a very wide stretch of what are now kind of off-street parking areas. Well, these are the areas that were bought out and demolished to build that freeway. Same thing happened in the South Auditorium urban renewal area, just south of what was then downtown. There were two Jewish synagogues. There was a prominent Jewish deli. There were hundreds of families that were wiped out. And the excuse always was either we've got to build a freeway or these are slums and we have to wipe them out.
Except so most of the people in those other two neighborhoods were white, weren't they, Richard?
Well, absolutely, because the city of Portland was then and is until this day vastly majority white. So, yeah, it wasn't racial. It was just that people thought we had a better use to make of that land.
Well, and in fact, then, is the settlement racial? If you went in and did things under eminent domain, this was all about a racial payoff by the current new, as you put it, you call them, what, 25%ers? Because nobody on the city council today has the support of more than 25% of the voters?
Absolutely true. That's built into the city charter. You can't get more than 25% of the vote. It's kind of a stupid system, but that's what we voted to do. Yeah, Loretta Smith, who is a person of color, made it explicitly about race, and a lot of the responses on the city council were explicitly about we owe black people some sort of restitution for what happened. The problem here, Lars, is that the people who were party to this suit, in some cases, the most connection they can make to the property itself was, well, we visited there, or we stayed there for a short period of time. None of them had any ownership stake whatsoever in these properties. The people who owned the properties are dead. They're gone.
Yep.
And dead people can't sue. So, you know, the public interest lawyers had to come up with a different reason. And the reason was, forget about the hospital expanding. It was just a plot to wipe out black people in a certain community.
And by the way, Richard, I'm up against the clock, but the last part I want you to hit on. There are people who say, well, if I still owned Granddad's house, it'd be worth a ton of money and I'd be a lot more prosperous. Except you pointed out some of the people who sold their houses under eminent domain bought other houses, and those houses are worth even more than the older house that was taken would have been worth. Am I right?
That's the ultimate irony. And nowhere in the lawsuit is it mentioned that the federal government and the city of Portland gave them tons of money to buy new houses, which they all moved into and which still exist and which are worth, in one case, over $1 million. So,
and yet that was the argument that was made. And then they had a deal to settle the suit for $2 million. And the city council said, this is about race issues. Let's give them $8.5 million instead. Richard, thanks very much. That's Richard Cheverton. He writes a Substack at Portland Dissent. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Larson Show. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google. Yeah, he's everywhere. The Lars Larson Podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails. And boy, the way the emails come, this one came unsigned, anonymous. Lars, I generally agree with a lot of what you say, but this issue of selling off federal land, I have to push back. It's not okay on so many levels. Yes, the federal government owns a third of U.S. land. Is management always perfect? No. But does that mean the answer is to sell it off? The real question is it the policy that's broken or the people enforcing it? What frustrates me most is the short-sighted thinking. You can't hunt, fish, hike, or find peace at a data center or a luxury resort. Well, apparently Anonymous was not listening, because I said, if you sell the land off, if it's forest land, and you sell, say, to a private company, we're selling you this forest land. It is to remain as forest land, and there are recreational easements on it for the public in perpetuity. That seems pretty clear. And if you don't want to sell it that way, fine. I think that people imagine, well, if you sell off BLM land, they're going to build shopping centers all over it. No, I don't think so. I think they're going to buy it for what it's worth. They're going to put it to its highest and best use and not build shopping centers and that sort of thing. And I think there's a way to get this done. But the first question you ask, you have to ask yourself is, what is desirable about having the federal government own one third of all the land in the United States of America? And the second question I'd ask is, are they a good manager of that land? Do they take care of it well? Do they serve the public with it well? I think the answer to that is no and no. Let's go to Dave in Talent, listening on KMED and the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program. And Dave isn't paying attention. Let's go to Josh. Hey, Josh, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
So, you know, I just wanted to talk to you about, yeah, the, you know, let me get off the kids.
No, I understand.
You know, we live in Grants Pass, and my wife is one of the head foresters for the Bureau of Land Management. And the joke with the Forest Service is, yeah, it's kind of a bunch of liberal people, and the BLM here is, you know, pro-logging foresters, and you see it. They like decommissioning roads and restricting access to the areas, and the BLM doesn't do that. And it's very interesting how the two agencies are so different with how they manage their land. And, you know, people get frustrated with that, but, you know, they don't understand there's reasons they might do that. And it's just pretty interesting listening to the back and forth with the public on how they just don't understand forestry. Like, clear cutting doesn't just happen carte blanche. You can't do that. And it just shows how people are ignorant with forestry in the area. It's fascinating.
Well, clear cutting used to be done, and in fact, let me ask you something, Aaron.
I think
clear cutting is great. And in fact, Aaron, if you went back 2,000 years, or go back 12,000 years, so before any human beings were here at all, even before the tribes claimed to be here 9,000 years ago, would you imagine that Mother Nature on a regular basis clear cut forests?
Yeah, through fires, basically.
Yep. And so if you want to tell the tree huggers, hey, I'll tell you what, why don't we do it the way Mother Nature does? We're going to do it, except we're not going to burn the trees to the ground. We're going to actually make use of them. I want to get Aaron Mesh on, though. We have been scheduled to talk to Aaron. Hey, Aaron, glad you could connect. Welcome back. And we got to jump right into this story that you did at WWeek.com, because it's a fantastic story. It is, once again, a great piece of ammunition for me. The government cannot manage anything, even a daycare. Would you mind telling my audience what's in the story? And I read the whole thing, and I was angry all the way through.
Well, Lars, I've actually got something for you that you don't know about yet, because the reason why I thought I wasn't going to be able to make it on the air today was we were in a hurry trying to edit a breaking story that just came out, and I'm going
to... Well, look, let's go to that instead. What's the breaking story?
Well, conveniently, they're similar. So Governor Tina Kotek has sent a letter to Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson urging her to reduce the scope of the preschool for all tax, saying that it is reducing the tax base in ways that could have unintended effects on the services that the state provides to poor communities because of the fact that so many rich people are leaving Multnomah County to avoid paying the tax.
You mean it never occurred to these rocket scientists, either at the county or the state, if we tax the bejesus out of rich people, they're going to move? They never thought that might happen?
I think it may very well have occurred quite a while ago to the folks at the state, but the county has been quite adamant that they don't want to to reduce the rate of this tax or halt its increase. And I think that now they have a fight on their hands with the governor, who says that that failing to reduce this tax is driving away a significant portion of the wealthy individuals who provide the state's tax base.
Now, I don't want to suggest anything ill to, about Governor Kotek. Did she get knocked on the head and become a conservative overnight? Because that sounds like a very conservative point of view. And I, if so, I'm glad. I hope she got it, you know, some way that was more, less painful than John Fetterman. But that really sounds like an amazingly conservative little, you know, maybe it's only a blip, but at least there's some conservatism coming out of Tina Kotek, because saying lower taxes so you don't scare the people who make the jobs and the income away. Great.
You know, I've said on the air before that Tina Kotek has proven herself surprisingly pragmatic as a governor during the course of her first 2 years. So I'll hold to that.
Well, you know, any young lady who can take stolen FTX money and use it to become the governor of a state, she's very pragmatic, sometimes not always legally. Let me get to this story, though, because this one doesn't stun me. They are so bad at managing things. So Multnomah County comes up with the idea of preschool for all. And they say, we have to have this giant tax. We're going to raise all this money, and we're going to get to 11,000 total spaces for kids to go to school pre-kindergarten. And how far are they along that path toward 11,000 years into this thing?
I'm sorry. I don't have the story in front of me, and I can't recall off the top.
Well, I looked for it in the story, and I couldn't find it. But here's the bottom line. They're driving private businesses that provide a preschool education out of business by the way that they're allocating this public money?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certain that it's less than 50, they're less than 50% there, like a good bit than less than 50% there. They say they're on track for 2030, but I remain quite skeptical based on the degree of the speed at which they're increasing the capacity of the program. And one of the ways in which they're having trouble increasing the capacity of the program is they are, in fact, they've now, according to this story that we've just published, driven at least one private preschool out of business, and not a preschool that wanted to compete with Preschool for All, but a preschool that wanted to join Preschool for All. And they couldn't provide enough seats for them to join Preschool for All, so the preschool is shuttering.
And in fact,
given how far we are from universality, like given how far we are from subsidizing preschool for all, it's fairly shocking that they couldn't figure out how to find another 16 seats.
No, because what they did to this woman is they said, we're going to, you have to make the cut. Even though she was already operating a preschool, you'd think if they've got this pile of money spent on preschool, they'd say, oh, you're already doing it. Why don't we just give some money to you and you just keep on doing what you were doing? Now, I don't like government subsidies. And frankly, I think preschool all the educational studies say it doesn't actually improve things for the kids. But that's an argument for another day. So she applies for it and they say, oh, I'm sorry you didn't make the cut this fall. And then she loses a bunch of her parents who say, oh, if you're going to charge us for this, the government is giving it away down the street, so we're going to leave. And that starts to drive her out of business. And then they said, oh, but maybe you'll make the cut in the middle of the year when we add some more seats. And then she doesn't make the cut, so she said, okay, I have no customers, I'm going to just shut this one down. And they actually reduced the amount of preschool that's available in Multnomah County as a result. The whole story can be read at WWeek.com. Aaron Mesh is the managing editor at WWeek. Aaron, thank you very much for the time. Glad to have you with me, and always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439 5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Check out our Instagram feed and our other social media. And you can always tell Alexa to play the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
AAV.org.
In a rugged political climate, he's the steamroller. This
is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Well, while American school classrooms burst at the seams and teachers are pleading for support, their union bosses are hitting the streets. But what are they out there for? Better classrooms, better discipline, any of that? No, they're chanting anti-immigration slogans. Are these so-called education champions really fighting for your kids? To get an answer to that, I thought we'd bring on Erica Donalds, who is the founder and chair of Optima Ed and chair of the America First Policy Institute Center for Education Opportunity. She's also married to Byron Donalds, but Ms. Donalds, I hope you remind him on a regular basis that he married up. You do, don't you?
I don't have to remind him, Lars, but thank you.
He just knows it instinctively. But tell me what should Americans make of the fact that we've got teacher union bosses out there advocating for illegal aliens to be in the country?
You know, it's really disheartening. I think teachers are really given the benefit of the doubt, and we have to make a distinction between teachers in the classroom who are passionate about our kids and the union bosses who, as you said, are out there chanting at anti-immigration protests. They are not here for kids. They're not even here for teachers. They've become a left-wing activist organization giving money to Democrats, funneling government funds through their organizations back to the Democrats who support them.
Now, why is it, though, that a professional class like teachers would put up with this kind of misrepresentation? You know, I've had teachers say, well, we can't do this, we can't do that. And I said, get your union in there. You got one of the most powerful unions in America. And they say, oh, we can't tell the unions what to do. They tell us what to do. And I think you're a bunch of professionals and you are represented by a bunch of people and you let your representative tell you what to do, not the other way around. That seems like, it seems like the teachers aren't taking full advantage of what they could say. We don't want you out there advocating for illegals. That hurts American schools.
Well, in so many states, though, the unions have passed policies that protect them from being held accountable by their members. In Florida, for example, we now have paycheck protection where school districts can no longer deduct money from paychecks to give it to the union. We also have decertification. If a majority of union members or union class members are not members, dues-paying members of the union, they can decertify the union. But there are many other states where teachers don't have that choice and they can't hold their own union accountable.
That's crazy, isn't it? I mean, to me, it would be like me going to a doctor and saying, I'm not happy with my doctor anymore. Fine, fire him and get another one. I'm not happy with my lawyer, with my accountant, with whoever it is that I'm doing business with who's supposed to represent my best interests. And they tell the teachers, you can't fire your representative. All representatives can be fired, even Byron Donalds, although he richly deserves to stay in the Congress. But this is a crazy situation.
Well, it's good that they're showing who they are. They also showed who they were in COVID when they did not want to reopen schools. They called it racist to reopen schools. While they were on vacation, parents were struggling at home to teach their own children because teachers, because of their unions, were restricted from even doing their jobs. So that's a good thing that's happened since COVID, is that the curtain has been pulled back. Unfortunately, the union stronghold is real in many of these states, and new laws are needed, including getting rid of their federal charter and the propping up that the federal government has done to unions over the years. And Supreme Court has also ruled in favor of teacher freedom away from unions many times. I think it's starting to break, but we have a long way to go.
And you're talking about the Janus decision primarily, where if you're in a union and you're a public employee, you're allowed to effectively quit the union, although technically the unions all claim they still represent those members, even if they're not paying. That's what they do, right?
That's absolutely right. But in states where school choice is expanding, now we have our 17th state just passed universal school choice in New Hampshire. Most of those schools are not unionized, and yep, does give educators an option outside of the government-run schools to practice their craft, be professionals, but not be tied into the union. We want to provide more and more of those opportunities for educators across the country.
You know, Erica, I agree with you that in a lot of ways it's great to see their true colors, although it's a bit like running into a brick wall to find out how much you get hurt by it, but because it has that effect too. But one of the things that's always frustrated me about the teachers' unions, the state that I'm in has about, I think, 75,000 certified teachers. And if they're all union members, that raises about $75 million. And every teacher I've ever talked to have said, do you realize that your representation costs maybe 15 or 20% of that $75 million? And they'll say, well, I guess. And they say, okay, what do you think they do with the rest of it? I don't know. And I say, I know what they do with it. They give it to Democrats, unless there's that oddball union somewhere that actually gives money to Republicans. They give it all to Democrats. And I said, are you a Democrat? No. But you're tolerating somebody taking your money, saying this is for your representation, spending 20% of it on representation and the rest of it on politics that you don't agree with, and you're going to let them do that to you?
Well, and even look at the topics at their national conferences, gender ideology, climate justice, race-based activism. There's almost no emphasis on reading, math, school safety, the things that are of most concern to parents and to many teachers. These are really activist organizations, and it's the first thing for parents and the general public to recognize this. It's another thing for teachers to have a pathway out. And more organizations are popping up that will service these teachers when they leave the union.
Ms. Donalds, keep up the good work at Optima Ed and, of course, America First Policy Institute Center for Education. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lars. I appreciate you.
And give my best to Congressman Donalds.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.